You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
I hope you've enjoyed the meal and the conversation so far. To get us started, we're going to hear from Dr. Peter Bettke. Peter J. Bettke is a university professor of economics and philosophy at George Mason University, as well as the director of the F.A. Hayek Program. Pete has served as the president of the Southern Economic Association, the Mount Pomeran Society, APPE, the Society for the Development of Austrian Economics, and is an founding honorary president and honorary president of the World Interdisciplinary Network of Institutional Research. Through an analytical framework strongly influenced by the paradigm of Austrian economics, as well as other intellectual traditions personified by speakers in the mainline of economic thought, such as Adam Smith, F.A. Hayek, Jim Buchanan, and Eleanor Ostrom, Pete Bettke has developed a robust political economy research program that expands an understanding of how individuals acting through an extended market order can promote freedom and prosperity for society, and how the institutional arrangements shape, reinforce, and inhibit the individual choices that lead to sustained economic development. His most recent books are A Struggle for a Better World, and Money and the Rule of Law, which is co-authored with Alex Salter and Dan Smith. This framework that Pete has developed, known as mainline political economy, is the heart of what we do at the Hayek Program. And Pete is the heart of what we do at the Hayek Program as well. His impressive scholarly research, exemplary teaching, and bold vision for our academic and student programs has shaped, influenced, and encouraged many of us in the room. And it's incredibly fitting that he kicks off the conference this evening. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Pete Bettke.
All right, well, before I get started, I want to congratulate Stephanie and Virgil Storr, my colleague here, on putting this together. It's just an amazing conference. And I also want to thank all of you for attending the first meeting of Markets and Society. There's over 250 attendees this weekend. And I also want a shout out, and I hope that you will join me in this, in thanking our amazing team that works behind the scenes to make all of this that we do possible at Mercatus's academic and student programs and at the F.A. Hayek program. So I want to personally thank all the staff for everything that they do. I'll tell you a quick story about the staff. We had our in-person, we returned in-person, this last year like everyone else did. And we had our big first conference, was over 100 people of students or whatever, our summer thing. And the worst thing you could possibly imagine happened, which is 2 days into it, we had like a COVID outbreak. But if you were actually part of the conference, you never would have known it. The staff just worked tirelessly. Every one of us had tests that we had to take every day, the mask. It just, everything just moved seamlessly. I would sit there, Peter Lipsy, I don't know if he's here, but, if I was him, I would have like shaken myself to death worrying about all the stuff that's going on after having all these people together. And they were like, I know that they're like ducks. They're calm as possible above the water, and then underneath the feet are moving really fast to make sure. But you know who benefits from all of that? People like myself. And I think that's one of the really important things that all of us as academics should remember, is that, our jobs are made possible by people that work as editors at journals, staff at journals, people at the publishers at books. I'm an editor at Cambridge, and I just put out a new book that came in, and the people that are working there to make sure it goes through the production process and everything are just amazing. So anyway, we wouldn't have half of what we did unless we had amazing people that we work with that take care of all of us. So thank you to them. I'm going to start with a story. In early October of 2009, I found myself in beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico, having a heated but fun conversation with a group of economists, as we all do around that time of year, about who would the following Monday would win the Nobel Prize. I spoke up and I said, "Don't be surprised if Eleanor Ostrom wins." At which point, all of my conversation partners looked at me with surprise and said, "Who?" And I said, "Eleanor Ostrom. I have a book with my colleague, Paul Alagica, on her in the Bloomington School coming out this fall. And she's made significant contributions to political economy, especially in the field of development and local public economics." You should note there that I didn't cite her most cited work, which is governing the commons, because I didn't want people to just think her work was about common pool resources, which is a mistake that people make all the time. But instead, that her contribution is this broader contribution having to do with the institutional analysis of development. My fellow economists, I will tell you, all chuckled at me, right? It'd be like as if I had said Daffy Duck was going to win. So they all chuckled at me, and one of them happens to be the person who regularly writes the column for the Wall Street Journal when the Nobel Prize is announced. And I turned to him specifically, and I said, "When she wins, call me. Let me write the column." Well, on Monday, she won. He called, but he didn't let me write the column. So I've been interested in the work of the Ostroms, Vincent and Eleanor, since the 1980s. And in particular, her work on rules in form versus rules in use, as well as their joint work on polycentricism, which played a major role in my own work on understanding the operation of the Soviet economy. And their work on institutions and development impacted me in my own efforts in the field of comparative economics that turned into the study of transitions, that turned into development economics. Now, for those of you who are here, maybe if you're older, you might remember this, but the Ostroms were forerunners in institutions in development. All right? They were writing that stuff 20 years before Bill Easterly ended up by writing a book which changed a lot of people in the field of development called The Elusive Quest for Growth, in which he says after every chapter, incentives matter because the institutions structure the incentives. The Ostroms were already talking about that. In fact, their book on the institutional analysis of development was so radical at the time, it was actually published by the Institute for Contemporary Studies or Society or whatever it is, studies, right? Which was like, you know, not a normal academic publisher. Which is another thing, the whole history of the Ostroms and how they fought is a whole other story, but we don't need to go into that. But also note what I just said, this whole issue of the rules in use versus the rules in form, the rules in form versus the rules in use, and that what we need to study as social scientists is the rules in use, not necessarily the rules in form. That changes the way we approach our academic research. It demands that we engage in field research, for example. Rather than the idea of the formal laws and whatnot, we had to actually have a more anthropological, more ethnographic move that needed to be made. And so when I moved to GMU in 1998, the influence of the Ostroms on my research and teaching came with me, including Vincent's work on federalism and constitutional political economy. I was very fortunate when I moved from New York down to GMU, I was given two classes that were dream classes for me. One of them was Jim Buchanan's Constitutional Political Economy because he retired. Now, I will tell you, for the first few years, it was a little weird because he sometimes sat in on the class. In fact, at one time, his secretary, Joanne, suggested that rather than me lecturing, I should just play the videos of Jim and then like be the recitation person. I did that, actually. It was weird. But then I also got to teach Don Lavoie's comparative economic systems class because Don was teaching in another part of the university. And so I had this dream that you know, was I doing? So part of the thing of teaching constitutional political economy is I brought the work of the Ostroms into that class. So besides teaching Buchanan, I taught Vincent Ostrom's The Meaning of Democracy and the Vulnerabilities of Democracy, a book that was published in 1997. 2004, we ran a conference to honor the Ostroms for their contributions to social theory. In 2009, my book with Paul came out on the Ostroms. And then in 2010, Lynn honored a promise to visit with us for an extended period of time, even though she had won the Nobel Prize. And she met with each and every graduate student and talked to them about their research. And one of the main things that came out of that was her work on what she called multiple methods methodology. See, Ostrom's work, work fits in the gaps of the other deep intellectual influences that impact our work, Mises and Hayek and Buchanan and Tullock, and it strengthens them. It's no intellectual accident that Vinson began his classes in public administration teaching Mises' socialist calculation essay. Public administration begins where the realm of economic calculation ends. All right, that idea was a crucial idea. Both Lynn and Vinson served as president of the Public Choice Society. Vinson tells us in the intellectual crisis of American public administration that we need a new science and association, and that new science was to be forged by public choice, property rights economics, law and economics, and market process economics. Paul Vlad Tarko, who was here, and myself picked up those themes from the intellectual crisis to try to develop a new art and science of association to fit with a self-governing democratic society in our book, Public Governance, a Classical Liberal Perspective. And it's also a theme in my own Southern Economics address. This research has evolved from transition and development economics to post-war political and economic reconstruction, as my colleague Chris Coyne, response and recovery from natural disasters such as hurricanes and more recently global pandemic, as the work of Stephanie and her colleagues, and financial crises, which you can see in several different essays, including from my colleague Larry White, but also many of his students, and more recently in this book on money and the rule of law. As our work has evolved, we've deepened our commitment not only to political economy and social philosophy, which is captured in our program's PPE title, but also at the work of the intersection of law, politics, and society in theory and in application. In an early paper co-authored with Virgil, we lay out this agenda of this triple embeddedness of markets for transition and developing economies. At the time, I had already been a fellow at Peter Berger's Institute up at Boston University and taught courses in economic sociology for many years at NYU. Dick Wagner was teaching a course in economic sociology at the time that Virgil and I wrote that. And Virgil and I had this great opportunity to go to Stanford to present that work in front of some of the top economic sociologists in the world. And so this connection of what we're talking about, markets and society, is a development and an evolution of an argument that's been around that traces all the way back at least to Don Lavoie as a stress of that. So when my economic friends gather in early October these days, besides my eternal wish that Israel Kirzner and Deirdre McCloskey win for the theory of entrepreneurship and the empirics of entrepreneurship, which I say all the time, and I'm very happy to say that, that I hope that they win, I also now tell people, watch for Viviana Zelizer, watch for Mark Granovetter, watch for Glenn Lowry, and for them to win. And why? And this you should say after me, relations before transactions. Economic lives are embedded within political, legal, and social environments. We cannot study them in theory, let alone in application, as disembodied entities. This isn't really new to anyone schooled in the history of political economy, for it's an argument that one can read in Max Weber, of course, but that means that one should also read it in the contributions of the Austrian School of Economics. Mises, Schumpeter, and Hayek were greatly shaped by Weber, and Weber, in turn, tapped into the Austrian school to help him significantly in his massive encyclopedia project, as you can read and the details of in Richard Swedberg's wonderful book, Max Weber and the Idea of Economic Sociology. Mises' socialism has as its subtitle an economic and sociological analysis. In fact, Mises does not switch to the term praxeology until the late 1930s. Because sociological analysis was sufficient in his mind. The core issue at stake is social cooperation under division of labor. Economic calculation enables the expansion and refinement of division of labor, which is a key characteristic in the move, as P.T. Bauer puts it, from subsistence to exchange. But calculation itself is embedded in a host of social relations defined by property rights, legal relationships, political structures, and social norms and mores. Again, relations before transactions. It's important to remember that Menger distinguished between three branches of knowledge within economic science: pure or exact theory, empirical realistic theory, and economic history. The way I have reconstructed the distinction in my own head is that the logic of choice or action, that's pure theory. The situational logic of interaction within an institution, alternative institutional settings, that's empirical realistic theory. And the application of that theoretical framework to that's developed by the logic of choice and situational logic is used to produce better economic history. That's a set of eyeglasses. What history is the reading, right? And we put on eyeglasses to be able to help us read the human condition. All right, it is in this realm of situational logic where economic sociology resides, where the analysis of markets and society is to be found. What I would like to focus on today with this talk is the puzzle of cooperation and anonymity that the Great Society forces us to address, how in the process of solving that puzzle, we turn strangers into friendship and to friends through relations of exchange, often bridging great social distance as well as physical distance. And that while exchange often overcomes social distance, it is also social distance that represents rather sharp objects in our interactions. And unless we can dull those sharp objects, we might face mortal wounds. So we have to focus on mores, norms, practices, institutions that mitigate the outcome of the great social distance. And then I want to explain in the end why it is that I believe that a renewed defense of cosmopolitan liberal order is actually the answer to that question. And I got to do it in 10 minutes. Okay. So we don't have to look very deep in Adam Smith's An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations to get at the fundamental puzzle. Smith tells us in the first chapters of his great treatise the following. All right, so now I'm not going to read the whole quotes that are in the paper. I'm going to try to summarize it for the sake of time, so just bear with me. So what do we learn in the beginning? We learn that Adam Smith argues that there's a natural propensity in human nature to truck, barter, and exchange. All right, it's this natural propensity in individuals. But in civilized society, these individuals stand at all times in the need of cooperation and assistance of great multitudes, while in his whole life, is scarce sufficient to gain the friendship of a few persons, right? That's the passage right up to the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, and the brewer, right? It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, the brewer, the butcher, the brewer, the baker that we expect our dinner, but from with regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of their own necessity, of our own necessities, but of their advantages. And then just a few pages later, Smith beats Leonard Reed by a century and a half, right? By pointing out that he uses the woolen coat, the accommodation, right, of the most common day laborer. So the most, just like the eye pencil, he says the woolen coat. And then he goes through, just like Leonard Reed does, all the various division of labor that's required and the various steps. And as he stresses, this exceeds all computation. And that we're dealing with individuals that we have no possibility of ever knowing and not having shared common ground with them at all. The miner, the builder of the furnace, the smelter of the fuel, the fuller of the timber, the burner of the charcoal, and so forth and so on. He lays all of that out and points out that that extensive form of division and labor produces what? It produces tremendous wealth. All right, tremendous wealth. Wealth, in fact, that exceeds that we could even imagine from 2 centuries ago that he's talking about, all right? And yet somehow the operation of commercial society, cooperation among strangers is achieved. Coordination of plans is realized. Wealth is created. The expansion of commercial life brings with it improvements in the arts and the sciences and in life in general. Productive specialization and peaceful social cooperation among individuals are achieved. Mises explains the interconnection of these two in human action. So now, I see pairs here or whatever. So I'm going to just say a little quick little story about this. So in the introduction to the Scholar's Edition of Human Action, Salerno and all of them, they go through the various things. They're talking about the history of the publication of the book. And they give a bunch of names that the book, could have been named, right? Which is kind of interesting. But when I was a graduate student, Richard Ebeling used to come around all the time and tell us that the alternative name that Mises wanted to name the book was The Theory of Social Cooperation. But that's not in the scholar's edition. They have other names that he has. And so I went and asked Ebeling for this conference, and I've been trying to chase him down for 2 weeks. And I said, Ebeling, give me the source, right? And he says, oh, I have it at home, right? But I haven't gotten the source yet. So I can't say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. But it might be wrong. It might have been just Ebeling making stuff up. But I want to believe him, so I'm going to say that. Because the reason why is because at the core of Mises' book is the human society, human cooperation. It's Ricardo's law of association is a key element to what Mises is trying to talk about. And so I don't think it's a stretch to believe that he would have wanted to title the book The Theory of Social Cooperation. But I don't have any evidence of it. So I'll steal the title someday. But what he does say, I think, is amazing, and I'm going to just read it out. He says, within the frame of social cooperation, there can emerge between members of society feelings of sympathy and friendship, a sense of belonging together. These feelings are the source of man's most delightful and most sublime experiences. They are the most precious adornment of life. They lift the animal species man to the heights of a really human existence. However, they are not, as some have asserted, the agents that have brought about social relationships. They are the fruits of social cooperation. They thrive only within the frame. They did not precede the establishment of social relations and are not the seed from which they spring. Relations before transactions. The fundamental facts that brought about cooperation of society and civilization and transformed the animal man into human beings are the fact that the work performed under division of labor is more productive than isolated work, and that man's reason is capable of recognizing this truth. But for these facts, man would forever remain deadly foes of one another, irreconcilable rivals in the endeavor to secure portions of the scarce supply of means of sustenance provided by nature. Each man would have been forced to view other men as his enemies, so forth and so on. No sympathy, whatnot. Those of you who've had to suffer through my lectures will have heard my claim that humans have two propensities, the Smithian one to truck, barter, and exchange, as we have discussed, but also the Hobbesian one to pillage and plunder. Which propensity is exhibited in human affairs is a function of the institutions, including the informal norms, mores, and supporting ideology within which we exist. If we live within an environment that rewards pillage and plunders and penalizes truck, barter, and exchange, think of the Game of Thrones. The Hobbesian propensity in humans, or the most recent one with the Dance of the Dragons, that's even more like kind of the ready. Well, both of them are pretty vicious. Those are Hobbesian things. The Hobbesian propensity will prevail, and we'll end up in a world of conflict and poverty, or as Hobbes put it, our existence will be nasty, brutish, and short. But if we live in a regime, as Vernon Smith put it, where the taking is only permitted with a corresponding giving, then our Smithian propensities will prevail and peace and prosperity will follow. So this leads us to this idea of how is it that we turn strangers into friends? One of the most intriguing books that I read during the pandemic, when I spent a lot of time with my friends called books, was by Francesca Trivolato, who's a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and her book is called The Familiarity of Strangers. In this work, she studies how the Sephardic Jews in the 17th century were able to develop trading networks that crossed great physical distance and religious prejudice through customary norms and social networks. These informal mechanisms, she argues, outpaced the rise of state and legal institutions. Her story is consistent with earlier stories about trading with strangers and how trust networks are formed, such as Paul Seabright's The Company of Strangers. Seabright argued that human beings are the only species that developed extensive trading and refined division of labor with strangers and were able to do so because the institutions provided the social trust required. Of course, Hayek stresses this matter in Law, Legislation, and Liberty. We have Jeremy Shermer here. He just brought out the Collected Works edition of Law, Legislation, and Liberty. Thank you very much for that work, Jeremy. It's fantastic. You should thank him. Yeah. In the second volume of that work, Hayek discusses in his chapter on the market and catalaxy, he says the following. The term catalactics was derived from the Greek verb katalinen, I'm going to probably say that wrong, katalinen, which meant significantly not only to exchange, but also to admit into the community and to change from enemy into friend. The puzzle of the stranger is highlighted in classic works of sociology by Georg Simmel and then later Alfred Schütz. Peter Berger attributes his own confusion and curiosity as an immigrant with American society to the pursuit of sociology in his wonderful book, Adventures of an Accidental Sociologist, a book I should add that I make a cameo in, so you should get it just for that. Though it's also one of my more embarrassing moments, as I picked the book up, I didn't know I was in it, and I was sitting opposite my wife in the airplane, right? So she's here and I'm here, and I'm reading and I see my name, and I scream out to her, "Rosemary, I'm in this book!" And then I realize everyone on the airline is like, "What the hell is this guy doing?" But I was quite excited and I was overwhelmed about it, but yeah, anyway. So how is it precisely that social distance is traversed and mutually beneficial exchanges are agreed upon and peaceful social relations are formed? In the extreme, as Simmel posed the question, how is society even possible? Okay? Hayek, following the footsteps of Smith and Mises, argues that the great society arose through the discovery that men can live together in peace and mutually benefiting each other without agreeing on the particular aims which they severally pursue. The discovery that by substituting abstract rules of conduct for obligatory concrete ends made it possible to extend the order of peace beyond the small group pursuing the same ends, because it enabled each individual to gain from the skill and knowledge of others whom he need not ever know and whose aim would be wholly different than his own. My close colleague Virgil Storr has written foundational text in this literature describing the market as a social space in which meaningful social relationships are formed. So let me repeat again, relations before transactions. But add that transactions often reinforce the relations, and those relations entail more than our transactions. Turning a stranger into a friend, not always, but sometimes, and sometimes in very significant ways, entails much more than we are just trading partners. We become partners in other things in life outside of our narrowly defined economics. Just like in science, the people that we work with become not just our scientific partners, but our friends. And we work with them, we debate with them, we discuss with them, we live with them. Human sociability, as Mises pointed out, is the source of our greatest joys. Choi and Storr have a significant paper in this vein as well, where they explore how the market process itself selects not just on the basis of getting more for less, but also on who exactly we can trust in our commercial transactions. Again, they are capturing the critical feature of the market that Hayek had also identified. In his essay on the meaning of competition, where Hayek stresses competition must be seen as rivalrous and not as a static state of affairs, as a verb, not as a noun, in the language I've adopted in the economic way of thinking and then in living economics, which more recently Brian Author has developed, in my opinion, a great persuasive effect in his essay, Economics and Nouns and Verbs. The distinction between viewing economics as a state of affairs, a noun, and viewing it as activity was also pointed out in an old essay by R.G. Collingwood entitled Economics as a Philosophical Science. Enough methodological divergence. What the Choi and Storr paper does is highlight what Hayek stresses in the end of that essay, The Meaning of Competition, that perhaps the most important aspect of the market of market competition is reputation and trust. As the old saying goes, it takes a lifetime to build reputation and trust, and you can lose it with one act of betrayal. Commercial transactions depend on networks of trust and reputation of partners to exchange. But each interaction also reinforces that network, or we discover that our partners are not to be trusted, and we seek elsewhere. As Choi and Storr point out, Mises captures this aspect of the market with his emphasis on the buying and abstaining from buying. The market process is defined by social relationships. It is ill-defined as atomistic and asocial. It is calculating, no doubt, but our ability to engage in rational economic calculation is based on social relations of property, contract, and consent. Without those, as Mises taught, we do not have the relative prices, the profit and loss statements, and the pattern of resource ownership that enable us to engage in the act of sorting from the array of technologically feasible projects those which are economically viable. At any point in time, the existing taste, technology, and resource availability is reflected, however dimly, in the relative prices prevailing in the market, the profit and loss statements reported by firms, and the pattern of resource ownership in commercial society. The underlying variables of the market are subject to ceaseless flux of, as tastes change, technology breakthroughs are made, and decisions are made that result in shifting patterns of resource ownership. The induced variables of the market will follow these changes. How quickly and how correctly, though, is a function of the supporting social institutions, including not only formal property and contract, as Mario Rizzo stressed in his timeless essay, Law Amid Flux, on the importance of stability and predictability in the institutional environment, but also in the informal networks of social trust and the supporting ideology, the social approbation and disapprobation of enterprise activity as reflected in our language and our discourse, as Deirdre McCloskey has so effectively stressed in her work of the bourgeois era. Sharp objects. Part of the puzzle of cooperation and anonymity is that the farther the social distance, including language and culture, the harder it is to build necessary social relations that undergird transactions. Our differences are our greatest strength, but they also are our greatest block. In the calculus of consent, Buchanan and Tulloch admit to this following difficulty. They say the following: our analysis of the constitution-making process has little relevance for a society that is characterized by sharp cleavages in the population that are distinguishable social classes or separate racial, religious, or ethnic groupings sufficient to encourage the formation of predictable political coalitions in which one of these coalitions has a clear advantage. Now, I actually refuse to acquiesce to the obvious logic of the conclusion of Buchanan and Tulloch's statement. We live in a rancorous world. We do not easily come to agree with one another. We fight, we argue. We have to be led into not seeing the other as a stranger, but instead as a friend, as we've just discussed. How we come to achieve that brings us to some extent back to Eleanor Ostrom and her polycentric journey with her husband, Vincent. Lynn dedicates her most cited work, Governing the Commons, to Vincent for his love and his contestation. In the documentary film on the Ostroms, Actual World, Possible Futures, which you can see on PBS, one of the opening scenes is Lynn with her amazing laugh and smile, which lights up a room. And she starts by saying that one of the things that they learned in their field work is that people argue. They disagree with each other. They don't come to automatically to kumbaya moment. This is one of the problems with the way people read the Ostroms, is they read them as like a hug it out, like, you know, like it's let's all get together and hug it out and hug trees or something. But that's actually not their position. That's just people reading that into them. Their position instead is, how is it that you form a self-governing democracy in which people radically disagree with each other? And that's where her work on institutions come in. They disagree and argue ferociously and about everything from conventional restrictions to who gets what, when, and who pays for it. But in a functioning self-governing democracy, we also have to work it out. And we are able to work it out because the contestation, due to the institutional structures, is forced to check against each other. Okay? And so that's the part of the polycentricism, the idea of the competing, functioning, overlapping jurisdictions. Through doing that, you focus this bottom-up process. What Eleanor allowed us to see was how we could turn situations of Hobbesian situations of conflict into Smithian realities of cooperation and coordination. There are so many little adjustments to theoretical social science that Lynn brilliantly makes along the way in constructing her argument in Governing the Commons that enable the actors in her field setting to take control of the situations and avoid the remorseless tragedies. The final section of Governing turns not to reiterating the problems of common pool resources, but instead to the implications of her work on self-governance for scholarship and for political theory. It is a section that we should all read carefully as we contemplate the shift in thinking required for us to focus on markets and society. institution must do their job of turning these sharp objects, that the cleavages that Buchanan and Tulloch identify, into dull objects that we may constantly bump into in our social interactions, but they neither block us from moving forward with interaction, nor do they wound us mortally so that the game of social cooperation ceases altogether. We survive, perhaps bruised and scraped at times, but also richer and more satisfied than we were before. It is precisely because we are constantly in the process of working things out that a political order that that enables constructive contestation is our salvation. Polycentric systems work best to help transform our differences into opportunities for mutual gain, for us to realize productive specialization and peaceful cooperation. So don't worry, I'm coming to the end now. Why liberalism? Economic lives exist within a political, legal, and social structure. They are not disembodied social structures. They are deeply embedded in them. The non-economic attitudes, beliefs, ideologies all shape the structures within which commercial agency is expressed. As Viviana Zelizer has demonstrated in her work on life insurance, as these attitudes, beliefs, and ideologies shift, so does the symbolic meaning of various acts. What was once considered crass and immoral now becomes the symbol for responsibility and prudence. When it comes to the matter of life insurance, those of you who attended George Mason University for graduate school should always remember Walter Williams' advice. He came home late one night, and Connie, his dear wife, informed him, "Walter, you scared the hell out of me." All right? At which point, Walter calmly responded, "We must have too little insurance." Always weighing the trade-offs in the marginal cost, marginal benefit calculation, Williams was just stating the obvious, that if they had enough insurance to ease Connie's mind, she would be indifferent between Walter returning home or never or coming home. There is a logic to this that we all must understand. But there's also something that's missing that's critical in the human experience. And maybe we should be discussing that as well. That's what Viviana Zelizer forces us to think about. That improves upon the existing explanations. The human condition does not work well when we systematically violate the rights of individuals and try to direct people in which way they ought to go. Deirdre McCloskey has argued that the great fact of human history, the hockey stick of human material progress, is the result of a change in ideology, not any other more materialistic explanation, such as the accumulation of capital. It is about liberty, but energized with dignity. There was a long march through history of the accumulation of various liberties. These are important and hard won, but they do not explain the hockey stick, according to McCloskey. I would argue that they prepared the way for the hockey stick, but let's leave my various quibbles with McCloskey aside for the moment. It is the emergence of dignity being accorded to enterprise activity, to entrepreneurship, to innovation, to giving it a go, that fits the timing of the hockey stick in McCloskey's grand narrative of the bourgeois era. I agree with her. She is right. She's not here to hear that, but she's been wanting me to say that for the last several months. So I agree with her. She is right. Without the ideological shift and without the shift impacting the attitudes and beliefs of the people, the practices that produced the great fact of human history would not have been pursued. The ancient virtues of the warrior are not, to put it simply, the bourgeois virtues of commercial society. As McCloskey is correct to indict, those who would tear that ideology apart. Right? Get ready, because this is a little dramatic, but the treason of the clerisy, as she put it, and make no mistake of it, the clerisy is us and intellectuals. Okay? The treason of the clerisy led in the 20th century to the pathologies of nationalism and socialism and national socialism. The work of our modern-day clerics provides scientific justification for such attitudes as scientific materialism, scientific imperialism, scientific racism, scientific Malthusianism. The result of this for humanity is horrific. The clerisy's anti-innovation, anti-market, and anti-liberty rhetoric is responsible for the horrors that we experience in the 20th century. Instead, what we need is Adam Smith's liberal plan for liberty, equality, and justice. But it's It's not some side interest of political economists. It's central. Lionel Robbins pointed out in his rather brilliant The Theory of Economic Policy that the science of economics co-evolved with these liberal institutions of law and politics. It is those institutions of property, contract, and consent that economic that create the framework within which economic life exists. It is the liberality of the mind, one of tolerance for difference, one of curiosity and learning, and the sensibilities that instills that allow us to spread commercial society. The due commerce thesis must be understood by economists just as much, if not more, than the ruthless efficiency of the competitive process implied in the law of one price. Voltaire famously explained the nature of commerce and those potential sharp objects. The Jew, the Gentile, and the Muslim enter the market and cooperate with one another to strike the best deals. And the term heathen is left only to those who do not honor the deal. Toleration is an outgrowth of the liberal order, as is civility in our dealings. And they reinforce one another, as I've tried to suggest earlier in the talk. The wealth and poverty of nations is a function of our ability to pursue productive specialization and realize peaceful social cooperation through mutually beneficial exchange. But that only happens if we exist within a political, legal, and social set of institutions that reward our Smithian propensities and suppress our Hobbesian ones. It is about beliefs, attitudes, and ideologies that shape our social relations and the symbolic meanings we place on actions and practices. So again, let me repeat, relations before transactions. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy this great conference that Stephanie and Virgil have put together and that you will join them in this intellectual adventure to explore markets and society. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.